used more than 150 lawyers. And we had to add it up the other day for another case. So that's a lot of work in terms of the legal fight. But there's something to be said that a small international investigative publisher is able to keep going under that pressure, and not only keep going, but to expand. Not many publishers have been expanding in the past 5 years.
Founder, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, speaking inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's taken refuge for the past 3 years. When we went inside the embassy on Memorial Day, British police asked the Ecuadorian embassy to hand over our identification. We refused. Just hours before we went to air today, WikiLeaks released more than a half a million U.S. State Department cables from 1978. Tune in tomorrow, Thursday, for part two of our interview with the WikiLeaks founder. We'll speak with Julian Assange about the cables, as well as the leaked Sony documents, the new ICWatch database, which culls personal details from LinkedIn, posted by former members of the U.S. intelligence community, and the inside story about why the United States forced President Evo Morales to land during the 2013 hunt for Edward Snowden. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, Hani Massoud, Mike Burke, Brendan Allen, Julie Crosby, Sam Alkoff, Renee Feldstein, Guzder, Neil Shabata. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Paul Rowland.
KBOO is proud to partner with Hopworks Urban Brewery for their Community Tap program. Every month, Hopworks features a local nonprofit organization, and May's Community Tap is your community radio, KBOO. Hopworks is located at 2944 Southeast Powell Boulevard in Portland. For more information on Hopworks and their Community Tap program, you can go to kboo.fm/hub.
Hey KBOO listeners, this is Stella from the Youth Collective reminding you to tune in Wednesday, May 27th from 6 to 7pm for our public affairs show. We have a whole collection of interesting pieces on politics this month ready for your ears. We'll talk about recent events in Baltimore, explore the history of politically fueled music, and share our opinions on corruption. It's a show you will not want to miss. So sit back, turn up the volume, and turn into KBOO 90.7 FM, Wednesday, May 27th from 6 to 7pm for your slice of current events on the underground.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a film screening of COINTELPRO 101 Monday, June 1st at 7pm at the Clinton Street Theater. COINTELPRO 101 is a one-hour documentary produced by the Freedom Archives, explaining an illegal FBI program coined as the Counterintelligence Program, spearheaded by J. Edgar Hoover, that targeted revolutionary of the 60s and 70s. There will also be a presentation of ongoing local work and Q&A session after the film. Again, that's COINTELPRO 101 Monday, June 1st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the home page under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories with a focus on natural fibers since 1984. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at GazelleNaturalFiberClothing.com.
There is a war between the rich and poor, a war between the man and the woman. There is a war between the ones who say there is a war and the ones who say that there isn't. Why don't you come on back to the war? That's right, get in it. Why don't you come on back to the war? It's just beginning.
here with a woman and a child. The situation makes me kind of nervous. As I rise up from her arms, she says, I guess you call this love, I call it service. Why don't you come on back to the war? Don't be a tourist. Why don't you come on back to the war before it hurts us? Why don't you come on back to the war? Let's all get nervous. You cannot stand what I become. You much prefer the gentleman I was before. I was so easy to defeat. I was so easy to control. I didn't even know there was a war. Why don't you come on back to the war? Don't be embarrassed. Why don't you come on back to the war? Can still get married. There is a war between the rich and poor, a war between the man and the woman. There is a war between the left and right, a war between the black and white, a war between the odd and the even. Why don't you come on back to the war? Take up your tiny burden. Why don't you come on back to the war? Let's all get even. Why don't you come on back to the war? Can you hear me speaking?
And good morning. My name is Paul Roland, and this is KBOO Community Radio, 8:06 in the morning, here in inner southeast Portland. And that was the great Leonard Cohen, "There is a War." God, there's some great lines in that song. War between the ones who say there's a war and the ones who say there isn't. Come on back to the war, don't be a tourist. That's to all you recent arrivals to Portland who may have tuned into our fair station. It's a long history here in Portland, Oregon. Gosh, going back hundreds of years, certainly 160 years to the Indian Wars. Never really ended, and people just keep coming and don't necessarily know the history. Then there's the war of the drug wars of the 80s that helped to radically transform our city, the areas where there's a strong concentration of African Americans in North and Northeast Portland, who developed communities over the decades since Vanport flooded and people moved into other neighborhoods and established close ties in the face of a fairly hostile white majority. And despite overwhelming pressures, harassment from the police, et cetera, et cetera. And then redlining came in, difficulty of getting loans, difficulty of maintaining their houses. Then the final, well, not the final blow, because there still are communities trying to hang on. The drug war, the importation of cocaine from through the Nicaraguan Contras and into inner city neighborhoods, facilitating the crack cocaine epidemic, so-called epidemic, makes it sound like a natural phenomenon. Anyway, don't want to get too far off on that. That wasn't my topic I was intending to get into specifically today, but, you know, just to say that we are in a situation of war, essentially. Capitalism is based on war. The establishment of the United States was based on war. And those wars, although they may have been pushed to the margins of majority consciousness, those who have eyes to see and ears to hear recognize that the war still exists. I'm thinking about this because I've been reading this communique from the Invisible Committee called To Our Friends from October of last year. I don't know if folks know who the Invisible Committee is. They're a group of, I guess, anonymous people from France connected to certain movements in France who've been putting out some really interesting writings over the years. I'd recommend people check that out. And this is called To Our Friends. Anyway, they're talking about the origins of democracy in the Athenian democracy, which was basically, as they say it, war by other means. That basically the Athenian democracy was a democracy of the warriors. One was a citizen because one was a soldier, hence the exclusion of women and slaves. In a culture as violently agonistic as classical Greek culture, debate itself was understood as a moment of warlike confrontation between citizens, this time in the sphere of speech with the arms of persuasion. All this rings so relevant to our current situation. Moreover, agon signifies assembly as much as competition. The complete Greek citizen was one who was victorious both with arms and with discourse. Above all, the ancient Greeks conceived assembly democracy in combination with warfare as organized carnage, and the former is the guarantor of the latter. It's significant that the Greeks are credited with the invention of democracy only on condition that its link with that rather exceptional type of massacre based on the phalanx, which is like a line, solid line of soldiers marching, armored line of soldiers, is glossed over. Let me reread that. The invention of democracy only on condition that its link with that rather exceptional type of massacre based on the phalanx is glossed over. That is, with the invention of a form of line warfare that replaces skill, bravery, prowess, extraordinary strength, and genius with pure and simple discipline, absolute submission of each to the whole. When the Persians found themselves facing such an effective way of waging war, but one that reduced the life of the foot soldier in the phalanx to nothing, they rightly judge it to be perfectly barbaric, as did so many of those enemies whom the Western armies were to crush subsequently. The Athenian farmer getting himself heroically slaughtered in the back rank of the phalanx in view of his friends and relatives was thus the flip side of the active citizen taking part in the boule, whatever that means. The lifeless arms of the corpses strewn over the ancient battlefield were the necessary counterparts of the arms raised to intervene in the deliberations of the assembly. This Greek model of warfare is so firmly entrenched in the Western imaginary, it's almost forgotten that the very time when the hoplites were awarding the victory to that phalanx of the two, I'm not sure exactly what this language means, but might be the translation, that would accept the maximum number of deaths in the decisive clash rather than yield ground, the Chinese were inventing an art of war that consisted precisely in minimizing losses and avoiding battle as much as possible, in trying to win the battle before the battle, even if this also meant exterminating the defeated army once the victory was obtained. The equation war equals confrontation, army equals carnage extended from ancient Greece down through the 20th century. It's basically been the aberrant Western definition of warfare for 2,500 years. That irregular warfare, psychological warfare, little war, or guerrilla are the names given to what is elsewhere the norm of warfare is only one aspect of that particular aberration. The sincere pacifist, one who is not simply rationalizing his own cowardice, performs the feat of being doubly mistaken about the nature of the phenomenon he claims to be combating. Not only is war not reducible to armed confrontation or carnage, it is the very matrix of the assembly politics that the pacifist advocates. I could go on. This is a very challenging and very highly recommended by me anyway, for whatever that might be worth, a piece of writing. You can find it online, The Invisible Committee to Our Friends. That's really just the beginning. It's a very nuanced, very extensive conversation about where we're at in the present day. So I was just going to start off the show with that. And I want to talk about, because I want to talk about the warfare that's going on right here in our fair city of Portland, the Portland police against the people who are represent, I would say, this system, among the people who represent this system most representatively, I guess that's a redundant, the homeless people, along with African Americans, Native Americans, women, other people who are the, I'm not sure how to say it, who are the ones who are remain relatively powerless in this patriarchal warfare system that we have. But I focus on the homeless because the houseless people, because they are, you know, this economic system which operates on basically eating up everything that it can in terms of the ecology, in terms of our precious life energies. It disposes of that which it cannot fully assimilate. It spits out, and you know, I'm saying this in very brutal, objective terms. I myself have never been in the position of having to sleep out on the streets, and I don't want to, you know, people are people, and people have their own life experiences, so I don't want to objectify the people who are in that situation, but from the system's point of view is what I'm talking about. So anyway, the Portland police are planning the toughest campsite crackdown in years starting this week, I believe yesterday. Portland police are planning their most intensive crackdown on homeless camping in years, saying complaints over entrenched homelessness have reached a tipping point. Whatever that might mean. Beginning Tuesday, yesterday, and extending to June, officers will target encampments throughout the city's central east side, demanding campers take down their tents and pushing social services on them. I heard someone say, and I don't know if this is true, maybe, you know, someone from the Portland police could call in to confirm or deny this, that they're actually offering people one-way tickets to wherever they want to go as a way of resolving the homeless problem in the city. So this is war. This is war on people who have basically, you know, maybe there's some people who've chosen to live on the streets. There might be a certain aspect of choice, but certainly I don't know of anyone who, if they had a choice between living in even the most minimum of indoor structure, if they weren't, you know, if they were able to do so, and having running water and bathroom facilities and a kitchen to cook in, would not choose that. But of course, the choices that are imposed by the system we live in dictate that those who are cast out from the economic merry-go-round that we live on are forced to live on the, you know, a lot of people living up against buildings. This is, we're here in inner southeast Portland. I see quite a few people, little lean-tos up against the sides of some businesses, people living in between the sidewalks and the street, people living under overpasses and various. And there's quite a few, that the number has certainly increased over the past several years since the, you know, our system had a collapse 5-6 years ago. And those people are unsightly to the some of the good citizens of this city, and they've been complaining to the police, apparently. At least that's what the word is. And so the police are now taking action in conjunction and obviously under orders of the city administration. So there are some people who are going around and advising people of their rights and talking to them. And there's some people who are filming this, and those would be good ideas. These are the people who really have very little support, social support, obviously, or they wouldn't be in the position they're in. And if there's anybody who's in that situation and wants to call into this program, 503-231-8187, if there's anybody who's got anything to say about this, who's been observing it, who's been trying to do something about it, who's involved in this issue, please give us a call and talk about that. So a number of things to talk about here. I went to the rally in Salem yesterday against liquefied natural gas pipelines and terminals. There's over 1,000 people there. Another way people can get back into the war, as Leonard Cohen says. This is certainly a corporate onslaught against the earth and its people. And there's a growing resistance to these pipelines and oil trains and coal trains and export terminals that are popping up all over the Pacific Northwest and all over the coast. And, you know, it's an integrated system of resource extraction and distribution, shipping, and the like. And we are right here in the middle of it. So we have one caller. Mitch, you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to thank you and tell you how much it is appreciated that you're talking about something that is normally pushed from the bounds of conversation. We hear the word stakeholder and shareholders in society so much, and we forget that the system really does not accommodate everybody as a shareholder or a stakeholder. And apropos of the point you're making about the homeless, the houseless, whatever you want to call people who are not actually making the choice to live outside, and I think that there's this great manipulation of people, goes back to the Reagan years, that anyone living outside in America must be choosing that. But the vast majority are still people who do not have an economic choice to be indoors. And I just wanted to call your listeners' attention to probably the best piece of journalism I've seen in many years, and it ran in the Portland Mercury either March or February, and you can search it under Somber Census, and it was a part-time census worker who was charged with going to homeless encampments like under NATO Parkway in the underpasses and the various places the homeless live, to count the people ostensibly for their benefit so there'd be a bigger budget for helping them. But the whoever wrote that piece in the Mercury did such a job of making everybody see it through the eyes of the person stuck in a fecal waste hole under NATO Parkway that I just think it's essential reading. I don't mean it to stress the disgusting quality of it sensually, but it's just something that we as a society need to look at and need to consider from that vantage point. So thank you, Paul, and keep doing what you're doing.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling, Mitch. I'm glad you mentioned the Mercury, because actually the article I should have noted that I read the headline in the first paragraph of, Portland police are planning the toughest campsite crackdown in years starting next week, did also come out in the Mercury. By Dick Van Dirk, I'm
Dirk,
sorry,
yeah.
Vanderhart, May 23rd, and I'm just going to read a little more of that because it, you know, got to hand it to the Mercury. They do take on issues that other people don't in this town.
And please invite them in, because the symbiosis between the old alternative press and what used to be the community broadcasters in the few Pacifica stations around the country, like the Village Voice and WBAI before it melted down, was it really got policy things happening in New York, and it got stuff happening. It still is getting stuff happening in the Bay Area in Oakland, And I just wish there'd be more of an open door policy, both from the Mercury to KBOO and from KBOO to the Mercury, because that symbiotic force is what's going to be necessary to change things. Thank you.
Okay. And thank you for that added point. So number of calls, 503-231-8187. People, if by some miracle, you know, large groups of citizens and non-citizens, whoever, were to make it to the inner southeast Portland where these homeless sweeps, I mean, that's kind of a really terrible term. That really is very indicative in itself, sweeps, like cleaning up a problem that would rather be not seen. Anyway, people could, go and at least witness what's going on. It's very close to KBOO, so I've seen it. I was, one feels powerless when one gets there and there's already a whole dumpster, a dumpster truck with the people's possessions already almost filled up and people's campsites already cleared. It's can be kind of distressing to see, let alone what it's like for the people who undergo that. They do say that they're going to just remove. There's been a lot of complaint about just this wholesale throwing away of people's possessions. I mean, if you're gonna evict people, at least let them keep, what they've got, and not have to, get it. I imagine must be very difficult for people to reacquire, a tent and reacquire whatever they had in their living situations. Some of these little camps are, I got to hand it to people. People are really very creative and do what they can under the circumstances that they have. Some of these little campsites that people have actually look, semi cozy for what they are. I'm certainly not advocating that that's a solution to the problem, but people got to do what they got to do, and then to have it all taken away must be really terrible. So I just want to read another sentence here and then go to another caller. For a couple of weeks, there's going to be a sort of ongoing effort to address the entrenched camps, Portland Police Bureau spokesman Sergeant Simpson told the Mercury Friday afternoon, adding cops will be looking to get people into services that are not connected now or avoiding them, clean up some of the garbage. Portland's got a reputation, that's an end quote. Portland's got a reputation for treating homeless camping with a relatively light touch, but is nothing new for officers to cite people. This is a Mercury article. To cite people for living in tents throughout the city, cops have been doing so for a while now, even arresting campers by leveraging the state's law against interfering with a police officer. I'm not commenting on the language of this article. I'm just reading what it says. The effort that will begin next week is more intense. In some respects, it sounds like the sweeps Mayor Charlie Hales ordered around City Hall in 2013. Simpson says orders for the action. He insists sweep is the wrong word, though many homeless people and homeless advocates would call it that, came at the direction of Assistant Chief Bob Day, who helped pioneer similar efforts when he oversaw the Bureau's central precinct. The enforcement comes as Hales and Commissioner Amanda Fritz say they found a new home for homeless rest area Right to Dream 2. It would sit just east of the new Tillicum Crossing Bridge, not far from the areas police are planning to clear out. So that's around Division Street area. And so, I've heard speculation that maybe there's been complaints from the central east side commercial interests about that sighting. Maybe that has something to do with these sweeps. I don't know if there's anybody knows more about that, who's involved in this in any way. Please give us a call, 503-231-8187. Now I see we have a full slate of callers. Let's go to one. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for this topic today. It's something that I really think is so important. I know, the concept, where do you live? And if somebody doesn't have a place to live, they're not living and they're not citizens, so they're not considered worthy of having a life or being alive. And I heard somewhere on KBOO before, which I think is really sad, and also on KBOO before I heard someone talking about, I can't remember the day, but homeless is like a commodity. Like there's so many services and shelters, and the amount of money that gets dumped into this and pays the administrative salaries is just awful. I think that everybody should have the right to have a decent place to live, and it's not decent to have a place to live, and people will better themselves, you know. I think the amount of money spent on one person in jail, for example, is $28,000 a year. I mean, $5,000 a year would pay a studio apartment for someone. It's just...
Yeah, jails, problem. Jails are the other solution to the houseless problem, that's for sure.
Right, and it's so much more expensive to do that, and the amount of money they spend on the police salaries, cleaning up these tents and the tickets and all those things, why don't they just build like a structure the size of the Marriott and have little like one room places where, I mean, supposedly there's 2,500 people homeless in Portland or something like that. I mean, really, it's not that hard. It's not that hard. I don't understand. It's just these people, and there's a prejudice against the people, like, oh, somehow they're incompetent, or they're not worthy, or they're incapable of making good decisions, and they're looked down on, and they're disparaged, and they're humiliated, and they're not worthy of being alive because they don't have a place to live. So, I mean, if you don't have a place to live, you're not living, you're not... That mentality needs to change. And that's
it creates the difference between, you know, those of us who... you know, have made it to be able to have the privilege and the benefit of having a roof over our heads. And so it's...
Totally. So anybody in those circumstances, I mean, if you don't have a place to live, I mean, you can't... I mean, the amount of stress and trauma that you experience and the humiliation that you feel inside of your own heart inhibits you from being productive in society and the way people view you. You don't even have the opportunity to make positive changes because they won't deal with you. And anybody in their, and a normal person, even in their right mind, in a circumstance like that, the amount of stress you're, when somebody, I mean, the effects of stress on the body, I mean, we know that that impacts decision making. We know that impacts a whole lot of different things. So to judge someone's character based on the circumstances that they find themselves in at the moment is really horrible. And not everybody has the capacity to achieve great things or have a marvelous career, or some people are lazier than other people, but that doesn't mean that they have no right to be treated as a human being and they don't have a right to...
Well, I don't know about laziness. I wouldn't bring that into it, but I...
Yeah. I mean, just that's the concept that people have, you know, oh, well, if we give them this place to live, it's just because they're lazy. They don't want to get up and do something, so they're not worthy of our respect. You know, we just need to wipe them out of their garbage, and that mentality needs to change because it's not true. Yeah. So thanks for letting me talk.
No. Continue. I mean, it's a systemic problem. I think we also need to see that, you know, there's a functional reason, you know, role for the people who aren't able to, you know, the system functions on people not being able to work. Unemployment is also functional to the system too.
Yeah, and then the system of like land barons, that was one of the big themes in the East, in England, and one of the reasons why the original forefathers wanted to leave that country is just the concept, I mean, the land barons and the people who are really rich and owned all the land and would charge exorbitant amounts for people to be able to live in Ireland, people would lose their farms. And it was just, I mean, we're in the system of land barons. You know, if you don't have the money to pay a land baron, you're not worthy of participating in society.
That's interesting that you say that, because I was sort of going to do a see how the show went, but I was going to do a little bit of like what I've been reading recently. So I read some from that, The Invisible Can Be, but I've also been reading a chapter from Sylvia Federici's Caliban and the Witch, which talks exactly about that time period and draws parallels to the current time period between the beginning of capitalism. What's that?
Absolutely. I mean, we as a society, okay, that can be an option for people who can afford that, but we also need to have an option for people who can't afford that or don't want to participate in that land baron, whatever it is, so that everybody at least has a place to live.
Well, the problem is
the size of a shack. I mean, they have their place, you know what I mean?
But I think the problem is that the land barons like determine the overall system, so we're all forced like participate in the system that they control. So there is,
they're not going to necessarily
willingly create a separate little system for those of us who don't want to participate in their system. I think that's an unfortunate problem that we're in.
Right?
Yeah.
How do we change that? Yeah.
Good question. Well, thanks for calling. We have a couple other callers, so I want to respect their being able to get on too.
Thank you so much. Very interesting. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Karen. And let's go to our next caller. William, you're on the air.
First of all, thank you so much for addressing this topic. It's, you know, I saw the report on TV last night and or a couple nights ago. I'm just astonished. I'd like to make a number of points. One of them, you know, it seemed to be the one of the major themes of the television reporting was that, you know, of the trash. And it was like, okay, if that's actually the issue, you know, people who have homes get trash service. It would be relatively easy for the city or a group of concerned citizens or businesses, if that's really the issue, to provide trash pickup.
No, but the problem is everybody's got to pay for their own trash service. Come on, you have to get with the system. If you can't pay for it, why should you be able to get trash service? I'm being sarcastic, obviously.
Obviously, that we could provide trash service, we could provide porta potty service. There's a number of other points so that I would like to make. If we, as individuals who do have homes, can just try to imagine what it is like to be homeless. Literally, anything that a homeless person does not that is not at risk. Or the only thing that is not at risk of being stolen, either by other people or by the police, by the power structure, is what is on one's person, ID, and how much else, you know. And then take a look at our lives, how much stuff we really value and do not want to, and we protect so heavily. It is so devastating what homelessness does to one's psyche. It is really quite remarkable if you actually, you know, go through it point by point what it's like. A couple other points I'd like to make. Do you know, in fact, anybody can go on the U.S. Commerce Department's website, and on there they keep track of vacancies in the United States, and they have for a minimum of 30 years. Do you know that the last time I checked was a year or so ago, that there are, according to the U.S. Commerce Department, there are just under 19 million vacant apartments and houses in the United States currently. The high estimate is we have 3.5 million homeless people. So we have already built in this country 5 vacant housing units for every single homeless person we have.
Right, but that goes back to my point of before. It's functional to the capitalist economic system to have those vacant apartment buildings. So
I would say it's not just functional to capitalism, it's functional to money itself. And a very simple question. See, we're all locked into a mental box, and the mental box consists of ideas like money is a necessity of life, time is money, money makes the world go round, and the idea that keeps our mental box shut nice and tight is the idea that there's no such thing as a free lunch. Now, I like to point out that there is no record in all of human history where the universe charged even one human being ever for anything. It's a 100% free lunch. The entirety of the universe, 100% free to us. We came onto the scene and started controlling things and withholding it from each other, and then developed a barter system and then a money system. So I would say it's far deeper than just capitalism. It is the idea of that we can control and withhold stuff from each other, which then spawned the idea of trade or barter, and then spawned the idea of money and then capitalism. But it is money itself that is the problem. And a simple question like, is there a better system than money for managing human affairs, cannot be asked, because we are all thoroughly convinced that money is a necessity of life.
But there's
two other points I'd like to make.
Okay, make them quick, because we still have a couple more people on the line.
In the Portland area, we have approximately 2 million people who have shelter. 2 million people cannot come up with a solution to homelessness, but yet we expect the 2,500 or however many homeless people we have to solve homelessness for themselves. It is so unbelievably ludicrous when you look at it from that perspective. One other point. when we as a culture, when we as a people on this planet finally put an end to starvation and homelessness and lack of health care, we will look back on these times and be, it will be incredulous to us when we look back and see the total lack of decency and humane behavior and the indecent way we treated currently 20 million human beings starving to death on this planet. We will be in shock that we allowed that level of disregard for our fellow human beings to
should we ever get on. To that point. Okay, well, thank you much so much for calling, and those are a lot of stuff to think about, and hopefully people will continue to think about it and talk about it. And so thanks for calling. And let me just let you know what's coming up today on KBOO. 9 o'clock, Political Perspectives. Journalist and author David Barsamian, host and founder of Alternative Radio, speaks on Capitalism and the Environment, Collision Course. This talk was recorded at a benefit for KBOO in Portland in March. At 10, Air Cascadia is off for the rest of the week. We'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on The Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter presents a recent talk by writer and visionary Susan Griffin on the shifts in Western culture needed for addressing climate change. And we would like to thank all of our KBOO members for your support in our recent spring membership drive. And if you missed it, you can still become a member or renew by going to kboo.fm, clicking on Donate Today. So we are talking about police beginning a new, quote, sweep of, quote, entrenched Central East Side homeless camps. My name's Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, and this subject has elicited quite a lot of interest. So instead of me continuing to talk, although I would like to say this is kind of interesting. Another thing from the Portland Mercury. Portland Police will work with the nonprofit group Join and a handful of other agencies to move entrenched homeless camps from the Central East Side Industrial District. Now, what is this group Join that's getting in on this? Maybe they think they're doing a public service, and maybe they're trying to like help these people out. And that might be true, and maybe it is a good thing, but they are also complicit as well. So it sounds like a kind of a tricky issue there. I just want to flag that. So let's go to our next caller. Nina, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. I have been homeless myself, and homelessness has absolutely nothing to do with laziness at all. It has very much to do with chronic illness, either physical illness or mental illness, that is not treated properly. And there are very little social networks to support people. And there's different populations of homelessness. There's chronic homelessness, which is the people that you're talking about that are being swept away abusively. And these people have chronic mental illnesses or physical illnesses that have not been treated properly. There's also the level of homelessness I personally experienced as a mother with children, which is couch surfing and living in other people's spaces to survive, because I myself had a chronic illness and wasn't able to at the time. I could work for a few months and then not and then not be able to. Again, there aren't networks to support people when they're struggling. I also have a son who now has a paranoid schizophrenia, and he was homeless for a year because he was untreated, and the social services are just not available. And for mental illness, we don't have even the slightest grasp on how to address that issue properly. So when you see someone who's homeless and struggling in the corner, it's likely that they're very sick. They're either mentally ill and need medication and they can't afford it, and they don't have the housing to support a treatment program. And so the next point I want to make is there is a man named Sam Tsemberis, and I will spell it T-S-E-M-B-E-R-I-S. He is a homeless advocate in the Mother Jones. There was an article about him, the Mother Jones, it was about a couple months ago, called Room for Improvement. And in Utah, he has transformed the homeless issue in I don't know if it's the state or if it's just specifically Salt Lake City, but he has developed a program that is a very commonsensical, but it's viewed as incredibly progressive, which is, as opposed to setting up stipulations for people, you have to get well first before you're allowed to be homed, you have to get off drugs before you're allowed to be homed, you have to take your medication and no longer be mentally ill before you're allowed to be homed. He homes them first, without questions. They wander the streets and they find people who are chronically ill, who are chronically homeless, and they simply put them in apartments and they keep them there. And they have almost eliminated completely homelessness. And of course, there's success stories with that. If someone has the grounding of a home and doesn't have the stress, then they're able to heal. They're either able to mentally heal or they're able to physically heal. So that's the points that I have to make.
No, that's I think I've heard of similar things, and it's, you know, there's kind of an analogy to, you know, a sort of minoritarian trend that, like, for example, in terms of medical care, where there's people, they focus on people who, like, visit the emergency room, like, the most times, and they focus on those people because that's where so much of social resources get deployed to people who are basically having to rely on emergency services, and it really drains the whole, whatever it's, whether it's mental health or physical health. And so focusing on the exactly the people you're talking about at a point where it can actually do them some good before, you know, because these things, you know, I only understand this a little bit, you know, because I've had, you know, my own brief experiences, you know, with mental, emotional difficulties. And I do know that there's like a vicious circle that can set in, you know, whether it starts from within or it starts from without. You know, you lose your job, you lose a relationship, you know, like one thing adds to another thing, which adds to another thing. And all of a sudden, yeah, you find yourself in a situation where you feel things are totally out of your control. And the thing
well,
to
I
do...
imagine on top of that being physically very ill and weak to begin
right.
with, or being mentally ill, which is even, I think, more of a barrier for my son, it was nearly impossible for him to even think outside of himself. I mean, you know, he's trapped in his brain and suffers for that on a, you know, daily. And so imagine having those factors, it's really difficult for people who are chronically ill to advocate for themselves, which is what we're supposed to be doing for them.
Well,
that is what we're supposed to be doing. The ones who are strong enough, who can make choices, we're the ones who are supposed to be doing that. This is the most vulnerable
right.
population.
But I would say, I agree. But I would say also that, you know, we need our own support networks to support each other in doing. I mean, and there's so many different aspects. You know, there's so many different things that we have to address that are created by the same systemic, economic, and other, you know, social distortions that are imposed upon us. So, you know, it's none of it's easy, but we need to create our own community support.
This guy has a solution.
I agree.
And although there's people that would, you know, that would argue against just housing people, he's also showing for, you know, for the capitalists that are obsessed with, you know, with hoarding all the money, he's also shown that it's actually, it's fiscally more impressive to do it this way, which is, mm-hmm. I know one of the callers had mentioned the expense of jailing or emergency room visits, and you mentioned emergency room visits, and I don't have the details, it's in this article,
mm-hmm.
but it was like a third of the cost of tending to, I mean, when people are homeless, they're chronically ill in other ways, they're chronically ill to begin with, that's likely why they're there, but then they're, you know, they're catching all kinds of colds and diseases, and, I mean, you cannot be healthy and live on the streets, it's not possible.
It's possible, but it's very, very difficult, I can imagine, you know, because you're exposed constantly. Listen, there's a couple other people who want to get on the air as well. I really appreciate the points you've made and the experience, personal experience you bring to bear. So I thank you for that.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, so let's go to another caller. We've got about 10 minutes left. George, you're on the air.
Good morning, Paul. It's such an important subject, and you launched it with this terrific point about the need to confront the war, I guess you would say, in its real everyday terms. We have to pry our consciousness away from some of the illusions we have. And this brought to mind one of the main points made a long time ago by a guy named Karl Marx. And he pointed out that there is a tendency when trying to understand our society to invert causes and effects and to, for example, blame the people who are the victims and let the system get off or not even think about it. And every now and then I hear something, someone says, well, the problem is this or that. Let's say someone says the problem is money. Well, it looks that way to most of us a lot of the time, but if we think about it, we might wonder if there isn't something to be said for the view that the problem is a system which uses every kind of habit or prejudice or weakness, socially, culturally, economically, to build capital's resources. So that's one point. And then I just want to mention an article I read a few years ago, which suggests something that Noam Chomsky has said for some time, that a lot of what happens under the rule of capital, he didn't put it exactly that way, but he said he was answering people who suggested that the system is responsible, and he was saying, well, actually, a lot of this is policy making, and he was suggesting, I think, that it can be confronted and that it's not inevitable. Although he didn't address the question of whether, if as long as you live in the system of capital's rule, whether you can really escape these things. But he was suggesting it's policy, and that's really important. And so I read this article a few years ago. The guy who wrote it has since died. I think he taught at Harvard for many years. His name was Nathan Kaifitz, K-E-Y-F-I-T-Z.
Okay.
And the title of the article, and it's online, it became pretty well known, is Consumerism and the New Poor. And it was posted to Society, the magazine or periodical Society, in 1992. And in it, he suggests that if you go back and you compare the societies of, say, America today in 1992 or anyway, with the America of 1900, you see some very different attitudes. And he says this is also true in Europe. And the big difference he noted was that back in about 1900, people who were homeless and were unemployed were very often, not always, but very often regarded as temporarily unemployed. And he gives an example. He says, even in Chicago, which was a harsh place to live in many ways, the climate was very harsh. And he said the police station, or stations in the era of 1900, very often opened their doors in very, very cold weather and encouraged people who were, you know, at peril of their of death in the cold to come in and sleep in a warm hallway where there was plenty of warmth. And he said, if you go and you look at our times today, what has happened in Europe and the United States is that a new view of the homeless and the unemployed, chronically unemployed, has emerged, and it is that they are basically people who are useless. He says this is the establishment's view, and my suggestion is that one of the most valuable things that KBOO has done for some time, and you were doing it and have been doing it, Paul, is to say, well, we have to look at the system. The system tends to do this, to marginalize people and then to blame them. It inverts cause and effect.
Okay.
And as long as we stay inside the system, we're liable to have this inverted view. But if we open our eyes and look above the, you might call it the walls of the labyrinth of capital, we can see that a better world is possible, but it's going to require some fierce struggle to put aside a system which has become a wrecker of nature and a wrecker of social justice.
Okay, well, thank you very much for calling.
You bet.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
And that's an article called Consumerism and the New Poor by Heifetz. And I just wanted to flag what the previous caller mentioned, this man, Sam Tsemberis, T-S-E-M-B-E-R-I-S, in Utah. And I just looked him up. He seems to be an interesting figure. I'm sure there's plenty of other people. There's also Right to Dream and Right to Survive here in Portland. And they are going to be doing their annual Pitch a Tent on Friday, June 5th, during the Starlight Parade, starting at 9 a.m. at Southwest 4th and Washington. People encouraged to, because there's this window of opportunity to legally camp in Portland for 24 hours, because, you know, people want to watch the Starlight Parade. So the Right to Dream, Right to Survive folks use that opportunity to make a statement. So that's Friday, June 5th. And I also just, so while I'm on that subject of coming up, events coming up, Monday, June 1st at 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m., there'll be a rally against the Oregon Monsanto Protection Acts, HB 3212 and HB 2509, at the Capitol Building in Salem. That's this Monday, June 1st. I don't know if there's going to be a transportation going down there. There's going to be speakers. And so check that out. As I said, yesterday's rally against the liquefied natural gas in Salem was extremely well-attended and very powerful, with a march to the Oregon Lands Board and a call out to Governor Kate Brown to end the land board, to nix, to veto, to deny these the liquid natural gas pipelines and proposed terminals in Warrenton and Coos Bay. So those are things you can get involved in. There's many things. Let's go to our next caller. Dennis, you're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I'm going to refer you to, and you may already know about this, this organization, which is very appropriate to this topic. And what I'm talking about is the Northwest Pilot Project, NWPP, and they are devoted to providing homes for the homeless. I think more specifically for seniors, but they may do it in general. They raise their money every year by having a walkathon, which is the people who do the walking, which is around the Portland State Mall, the Park Mall. The people who do the walking are sponsored by other people who donate money, and they have raised, one person raised $80,000 this year.
Great.
So they get a lot of money, and they do good things.
Well, personally, I think we need
to have maybe invite one of those people, one of the people in the organization onto your program. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, actually, that's a great idea, and I think these nonprofit agencies that raise money and do things. My personal feeling is we need to organize directly with the houseless people, and you know, take over the. Well, I don't know. I mean, those are grand dreams. Take over. What am I saying? Who are we? Who am I? Anyway, I think we do need to organize directly with houseless people, and not just try to, you know, be do-gooders and help them have a leg up. We need to actually organize directly with them, because our interests are the same. So let's go to a next caller. We have room for one more caller. James, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, so I'm reminded of a quote. I don't think it'll be exact, but it's Martin Luther King said, "Philanthropy is good, but don't forget the edifice which makes it necessary for philanthropy to exist." And you are exactly right. I mean, we treat homeless folks like they're a bunch of kittens and puppies in a box. You know, like, oh, we need to do something for all these cute homeless people. You're right. You know, we need to start organizing with them and start treating them not as the other or as this helpless group. I mean, there's so many educated homeless people. I spent a couple years being homeless myself, and it's a completely different world when how people treat you when you say you don't have a place to live. It's ridiculous. And, you know, I mean, I've consider myself lucky. You know, I'm a pretty determined person. I figured it out, but not everybody's the same way.
That's true. Well, as you hear, we got our theme song for the day coming up, James. Sorry we didn't get a chance to go a little more deeper into what you're saying, but appreciate it. And sorry to those people who did call in and weren't able to get on the air. Appreciate everybody who called in. This is a conversation that needs to continue. Go down to the inner southeast Portland, check out what's going on with these homeless sweeps, and bring a camera, video camera. And that's all I got to say. My name is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank you so much for listening. Coming up, David Barsamian. Kind of nervous. As I rise up from her arms, she says, I guess you call this love, I call it service. Why don't you come on back to the war? Don't be a tourist. Why don't you come on back to the war before it hurts us? Why don't you come on back to the war? Let's all get nervous. You cannot stand what I become. You much prefer the gentleman.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Student Debtors Assembly. Thursday, May 28th, 2 p.m. in the Park Block at Southwest Harrison in Portland. A debtors assembly is a public forum to talk about debt, to dispel stigmas, myths, and taboos about debt, to learn about debt, and to organize to change the state of debt in our lives. There will be presentations from organizers, academics, debtors, artists, and musicians, and there will be opportunities for everyone to share openly about their debt and how it affects their lives. Again, that's the Student Debtors Assembly, Thursday, May 28th at 2 p.m. on the PSU Park Block near Southwest Harrison. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage on the community events.